Thanks, Steve. Thank you, Arthur and Mary Louise, for having us both here. I somehow get this reputation, and I don't quite know where that I suspect, probably, yes. Before I hand over to Johnny, I just want to say a few things about the collaboration that we've been working on. It's been going now for a couple of 2 or 3 years, and this is the third or fourth performance, installation, rehearsal, whatever. Johnny will probably say more about that when I hand over, that we've done. And it comes out of my own kind of interest initially in political economy. And what I'm trying to do with this performance and other work that I'll mention briefly is to augment traditional political economy approaches to technological environments. And I'm augmenting it with acoustic thinking. And that is a term that I've taken from a number of sources, not least from Johnny. And that idea of acoustic thinking is about positioning theory and inquiry in a 360-degree environment, as opposed to a kind of visual 180-degree flat screen environment. And that throws up the idea, I think, or we're working on the idea, that it throws up the concept of listening very much, that perhaps there's an over-reliance on blocking and not enough attention to listening. So this idea of acoustic thinking is kind of hopefully working to augment traditional political economy. It's also drawing on science and recent work that I've been looking into, where scientists are beginning to listen to the activities of stars as opposed to just observing them. So that kind of idea feeds into the work. I just want to make a couple of quick references to people who are working this area, and to say that I'm drawing initially on somebody called Jacques Attali, and he's written a book called Noise, the Political Economy of Music, and that was a really interesting starting point for my work. And I just want to give you a quick quote that I think sums up there. It says that today our sight has dimmed, it no longer sees our future, having constructed a present made of abstraction, nonsense, and silence. Now we must learn to judge a society more by its sounds, by its arts, and by its festivals, and by its statistics. So that, I think, sums up partly what it is I'm trying to do, or partly what we're trying to do. However, if you pursue Attali's line of thinking in the book, he continually draws or gets drawn back into a kind of linearity, and he becomes quite predictive. And his basic premise is that if you want to know how a society is going to change, then you listen, or you go to the music. And he suggests that music in any political situation outstrips. It's a marker of change. It's a marker of things to come. And that, I think, brings us back to this idea of time and linear time that we've been talking about. That is a concept that I think we're trying to get away from. So if Attali is the beginning point, then that itself is augmented by somebody called Paulina Oliveras, some of you may know her work, and the concept of deep listening. And Paulina Oliveras, just again, just give you another quote, says that the level of awareness of soundscapes brought about by deep listening can lead to the possibility of shaping the sound of technology and of urban environments. Deep listening designers, engineers, and city planners could enhance the quality of life as well as sound artists, composers, and musicians. So this idea of deep listening then is being used as well as Attali's work on political economy. And that's kind of led us, or led myself and Johnny, to begin to put together not just these performances, but a number of research projects. And one of those that I just wanted to mention, and I think others people may be interested in it when we get this off the ground as part of the new institute, is something called the Motor City Project. And what we're going to do, hopefully, is to assess the political and the economic and the technological environments of Coventry and Detroit, and use the music that comes out of those two cities as a way of getting at things that may not be accessible by kind of traditional methods. So that's something that perhaps we can discuss over. Okay, I think that's probably enough. I'll now hand over to Professor Golding and get over to my computer. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. I just have a very much shorter thing to say, because I think the text will end up speaking for itself. I hope it will. We're going to do this in the dark. I would like it, if you felt like it, you can shut your eyes. I mean, usually, not usually, but I think I've said to some people, I've always wanted it really, really, really dark, so you can't see anything. And the only time that actually happened, so that it was so dark, we were in a vault, a bank, actually it was just by myself, Steve wasn't with me, but I was in a bank vault in Istanbul, and that was really dark, but unfortunately the generator broke, and all the electricity made the bank vault locks lock. So,
your wish was fulfilled.
Yeah, it was definitely in the dark. I'm talking about nightmares, okay? The idea here is to get a sense of how sound and what's being said. Well, there's two things. One is the conceit of philosophy, and definitely the conceit of philosophers, is that you give a paper and everybody either understands it or understands part of it and they ask you things about it. There's no way that you're going to remember all of this paper. I mean, it'd be very bizarre. Even I can't remember, and I've actually been working on it. So it would be very odd. So the real question is, what are you going to remember? And how is it that the sound, the music that Steve has either composed or he's put together in different digital trackings, how it weaves into and makes its own comment along with what the text is doing. Now, what the text technically is doing is what I call rehearsing. And I call these moments philosophical installations. So they're like a living moment. It's not really well, it is obviously a performance on one level, but it's not a performance in the sense that I don't know really how it's going to come out. I mean, I know there's a text, I know that there's sound, we have about 30 minutes and so on and so forth, so we have these parameters. But beyond that, it's not clear. Just that the idea that it's in the dark, hopefully Mary's light works, the thing works, everything works, and I think that's going to be it.
My 313 laboratories. When machines exceed human intelligence.
You need to know more. I tell you something you do not need to know. According to government protocol, you have the duty to report me as a spy, or at worst, leak. According to military protocol, you have the duty to report me as a messenger who may or may not be shot. According to educational protocol, you have the duty to report me as research, and in so doing, footnote the exchange. But I'd like to say, the need to know law is all for the wrist. Closer to new forms of social agency and economies, a kind of how you play the game, or how the game plays you, whilst the band just plays on. Ownership in the 21st century has intellectual property and the need to know. This text is a conversion on the road to Damascus, minority port of the political, or how to have an adventure after metaphysics. You might want to call it how to tremble to zero. Ecce homo. This man, this woman, this hermaphrodite, this androgynous, this ish, and no other. Today I am part thief, part iron claw, transformed in the first instant as a swift and shadowy runner, skimming the surface of greasy back alleyways with goods close to hand. Nothing stops me, not sirens, not wounds, not the filthy, dirty air. Nothing impedes my rush, but at the slightest sniff of danger, I can transform. Oh, I can transform. I can transform into a blue flower, or maybe a nasty coral reef. Or perhaps just some old rusty tractor digging and banging and digging some more. Same place, same time, same rhythm. And I think to myself, isn't it just grand, how the ground gets way under my imagination? Maybe this is what it means to make a gesture toward aesthetics in the age of relativity and technological change. I want to say yes, but not exactly. Thus, as it was recorded in the year of our Lord, 1611, the New Testament, Acts of the Apostle, 28, quote, saying, go unto this people and say, hearing ye shall hear and shall not understand, and seeing ye shall see and shall not perceive. For the heart of this people is waxed gross, and their ears are full of hearing, and their eyes they have been closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and should be converted, and I should heal them. So it was that Paul strode from Rome, assured in his new role as apostle, having himself seen the light and heard the voice on that now rather infamous road to Damascus. Revelation as a secret telos of metaphysics, light as voice as ontology. From blind man's soul to clear-sighted Paul, his conversion was total and absolute. Engineered as it was by the Heavenly Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, whose miraculous energies simultaneously pushed him forward, whilst grounding him utterly and completely to the path. This old metaphysical and dialectical chestnut, despite many translations on the teleological theme, could be restaged as follows. A fundamentalist religious fanatic in the abstract representation called Saul, whose nastiness included, indeed was consummated by the carrying out, whenever and wherever possible, of the final solution against those moral beasts, believing to the resurrection, found himself on one otherwise eventful day, transfixed and sublated, point for point, into his utter contradiction, the equally rabid, though not yet fully realized, Paul. This abstract Paul, whose incomplete cogency was around the miracle of seeing and hearing the revealed truth of transubstantiation, was at that very same instant imminently transcended and commanded to be so, and thereby fully synthesized in the wake of this movement as both messianic apostle Paul and the very ground of a universalized faith. Full revelation then, as a secret telos to metaphysics, light and voice, maybe as ethics. It is well known in the everyday vernacular of philosophy, properly speaking, that two kinds of truth take precedence, revealed and natural. In the former can be placed unexplained events, miracles, commandments from on high. This requires a certain kind of teaching, a certain kind of memory, a certain kind of interpretation, and a certain kind of discovery. It requires a certain kind of adherence to a narrative, to a big L law, and therewith, as noted above, to faith. Conversion brought about on this form of adherence is its essential feature. Oh, it's an essentialism residing precisely in the sublated mood, conversion, from the one side to its antithetical other, with an imminent transcendence onto the righteous path, or the morally corrupt one, depending on one's ability to hear, see, listen, act, imagine correctly, remaining close at hand. It is in this sense that metaphysics always requires some form of revelation to make its ethical move. Revelation, then, as secret telos to metaphysics, but maybe this time, light and voice as the epistemological is of being. One of the important aspects of this form of revelation was, of course, that it brought the human condition front and center to the future, to knowledge, heretofore regarded only as the providence of God. Change was to be rooted in human will, where revelation would be sutured on the grounds of certainty. And while it may be true that certainty could and did imply probability, and probability could and did imply error, and error could and did imply human fallibility, revelatory truth did so only on the basis of the binary contradiction, either or, friend enemy, yes no, self other, terrorist democrat, man woman, Jew Christian, days straight, hardest to count, all set in a totalized field and offered up to the absolute. Enter Descartes, doubt has ground to being. Descartes was not the first to challenge this view, but he certainly was one of the first to pose doubt with a different sort of character than that which might be linked to discovery. For him, he was neither attached to certainty nor to that of uncertainty. To doubt was for Descartes a kind of unsayable something, a kind of unsutured positivity of logic, wherein stood the last bastion of apodictic thought. One might doubt one's eyesight, one might doubt one's hearing, one might doubt one's very existence, but one could not doubt itself. Oh, it was a clever move, wherein the existence of one's being took the form of a duly devised cogito. I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am. To put this slightly differently, doubt was to be the ground upon which and the propeller for which the being of human was to be conditioned, and more to the point, ought to be the basis for all human reason, and indeed for all humanity. As Hannah Arendt was later to rephrase it, doubt was not and is not to be pitted against thought. It is thought, the very condition of life itself. Foucault would take it one step further. Doubt was to be the very basis of imagination, creativity, and indeed a stylistic of existence. I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I invent, therefore I am. Discovery as revelation, as truth, has nothing to do with it. Secular enlightenment, for the holy marriage of Cartesian doubt with Kant's superi audi. With a battle cry, dare to know, Kant did more than simply acknowledge the individuality of being human as that which must be linked with the sensuousness of doubt. By asking the question in the way that he did, that is, as a demand, supposing it could be otherwise, what would your otherwise look like? It was an odd sort of map, an odd sort of journey, an odd sort of thing that began to replace the tried and true cartography of original sin and all its revelatory truths. For change, conversion, movement itself was now to be attached to a kind of journey connected to invention, taste, assemblage. That is to say, a kind of knowledge that brought to the fore the realization that anyone, indeed everyone, could exit the shackles of an imminent existence. At the very minimum, all that was required was the knowledge that one could doubt, and more importantly, the courage to do so. And so it was with this form of enlightenment that the first unsanctified crime in the system surfaced. Truth or consequences. Apart from the many long-winded consequences filtering out of this particular age of reason and enlightenment, came a shift in what might mean to be an artist. Hitherto, an artist was rather like a vessel through whose body can flow the creative eye, taste, energy, and whims of God. But now if it were true that creativity was no longer the province of God, but might also be connected to or produced by one's own dynamic version of reason, one which lay at the very core of being human, meant that the human artist-type being did not simply or only conduct or translate the word, vision, spirit of God neatly onto canvas, sculpture, or sound, but that he or she was a creator, or anyway, might be. Now, it would be one thing, one not too bad thing or too awkward a thing, given this trajectory, if the artist was never quite as good as God. But what if? What if the artist were better? An imprisonable offense held without bail, to be sure. The fudge factor. And so entered the first of many technological and technicolored fudge factors, political, philosophic, scientific, aesthetic, and ethical reason, how to square the wildly expanding journeys to which inhabited reason might lead. Pathways. Pathways which would take one beyond the horizon of one's own worldly worlds. How to square this with the cultural fermentation, beliefs, and common senses of the day. Perhaps it was just best to say, as it was said in the book and elsewhere, that man could only ever approach God, but not become, or dare be suggested, exceed God. Interlude as chorus. Looking versus reading. Hearing versus listening. Smelling versus sniffing. Perhaps it can be best understood like this. Oh, you can look at something without reading it, but you can never, ever read without looking. The same could be said of hearing and listening. Oh, the latter requires the former, whilst the former just is. Perhaps it might be fair to say, then, that in the case of reading or listening or sniffing, translation forms the hinge of its truth. It gives reading, listening, sniffing a kind of unspecified mobility and depth of the immediate surface circuitry, a surface circuitry somewhat absent from simply looking, simply hearing, simply smelling. But if this is really the case, then it means that there just must be at least two kinds of is's, one and the same time. That is to say, the is that just is, and the one that is to be. I want to say this two-headed is has something to do with duration, length, distance, intensity, speed. But that's another matter. Another mobile, multimediated matter. An ars erotica as ars scientifica matter. Valuing the mediocre then as precious, God's dead. Within the gay science, and as further developed in his will to power, we all know neatly summarized this crack in the system, with that unforgettable utterance, God is dead. This, of course, was no ordinary death sentence, and it certainly did not mean what Hegel took it to mean when, some early years earlier, Hegel penned a similar decree, flatly condemning the New World Order as being enveloped by, quote, the feeling that God himself is dead, unquote, in Hegel. For Hegel, the fear was precisely that people were turning away from God, but for Nietzsche, it was precisely the reverse, the fear that they were not turning away fast enough, not so much from God himself, but from the need to find spirit in a totalizing, red, universal form of truth. What had died for Nietzsche was an entire moment, not so much in history, but of history itself, that is to say, the cultural condition that placed metaphysics as the new godhead of meaning, change, progress, prediction, man-made in all its mediocre glory. His God is dead was not so much a lament as it was a wake-up call, attempting to remind all of us who needed reminding that the time was nigh to rip centuries knowledge, creativity, fearlessness from the mastus of a resurrected, eternally unfolding existence and be brave enough to look at it in the void and to deal with it as it actually was, would be, might have been, could be imagined. It was time to get rid of this decrepitude, empty shelter called metaphysics, and to embolden the is with an ever-expanding intensity beyond that of doubt, daring, or stylistic existence. But the move, this call to arms, didn't work. Oh, he was writing before his time. The madman from Nietzsche. Quote, have you not heard that madman with the lantern in the light morning hours ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, I seek God! I seek God! As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around at that moment, he provoked much laughter. Why? Did he get lost? Said one. Did he lose his way like a child? Said another. Is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Has he emigrated? Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced him with glances. Whither is God, he cried. I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink of the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon. What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving now? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging, continually, backward, sideward, frontward, in all directions? Is there any way up or down left? Are we not straying as though through an unfair and infinite nothingness? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is it not night and more night and more night coming on all the while? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not know of anything yet of the noise of grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? Oh, God's too decomposed, you know. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? What festivals of atonements, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is it not the greatness of this deed that is too great for many of us? Must not we comfort ourselves to become gods simply to seem worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and who shall ever will be born after us? For the sake of this deed, he will be part of a higher history than all history hitherto. Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground, and it broke out and went out. I come too early, he said. My time has not yet come. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of man. Unquote. Oh, it was not so much that one was too afraid to peer into the abyss, thought Nietzsche. It was rather that we were not afraid enough. For Nietzsche, the intimate chemistry of change was always already connected with life force. Life force with power. Power with mastery. Mastery with change. Change with life force. And then a repeatable pattern. The chemistry of change is connected to life force. Life force with power. Power with mastery. Mastery of change. And then a repeatable pattern. The chemistry of change is connected to life force with power, power with mastery, mastery of change, and etc. This, and not transcendence, dialectical or otherwise, was the eternal return. Always already returning an intensity, an erstwhile will to power through a repeat performance that both copied itself and in so doing created anew, a kind of algorithmic remembering. A re-remembering, a kind of mimetic repetition, a network logic of the genus, a genealogy, one without a predetermined cartography, but also one without an inside or an outside to the real. Simply an affirmation of intensity, an objective intensity, transcending value, and in that seductive curiosity, simultaneously forming the very basis, the very process, the very goal the present tense is. A singular surface beyond the usual goalpost of good and evil, a pattern revealing and concealing at one and the same time what might easily name as camouflage. Enter Einstein. The equal sign as the will to energy. Rather than couch the discussion in terms of power as synapse between two endpoints, Einstein simply inverted the dynamic of power with that of energy, without reverting back to insides and outsides, God to transcendence. In his famously and elegantly simple statement of E equals MC squared, the very dynamic synapse of relativity would be held in position not by the grasp of the out there to itself, but by the very cohesiveness imbued by the equal sign, whose variable counterpoints could shift or change, but only in relation to a given intensity. Gone, the endpoints, the closed circuit systems. Enter a relativity possible by virtue of the will to cohere, a will of intensity within a variable statement secured and propelled by possible but no less real paradigm shifts of speed, distance, mass. of life, like Escher's two hands drawing themselves, this fractal of pattern or semblance requires no observer, no subject, no God, or indeed any outside as any feature to the aesthetic imagination, much less to one's ability to create the is of life itself. On the other hand, especially in the general relativity theorem, how could one square the ever-expanding universe with the notion that there was no outside? Like Escher's two hands drawing themselves, the very thought belies a certain kind of logic. It was creepy and zen all at the same time. You know, how long is this piece of string? Well, it's this long. And what of that silent mass of anti-space, anti-matter, anti-energy? Well, Einstein had an answer to this too. He called it a kind of cosmological stasis, which occurred if one took the logical probability of high-density dynamic relativism to its nth degree. At some point, there would have to be stasis, despite an ever-expanding universe. If one stayed within traditional physics and mathematics, this conclusion was a logical impossibility. That is to say, to have an ever-expanding universe and, as well, cosmological stasis. Rather than throwing out the entirety of general relativity theorems, however, Einstein added yet another fudge factor. He couldn't quite prove what he was saying, or its impossible conclusions, but by all rights, cosmological stasis made sense. It just made impossible sense. To put it slightly differently, his resolution suggested not only was there not exactly a nothing or void or lack before there was a something, but given the curvature of time-space itself, this nothingness had a kind of shape or fold we might nowadays call a black hole elsewhere, filling in the gaps, as it were, in our ever-expanding universe. And if you think this is strange, how much stranger, how much more so, to find out, as was recently recorded by satellite technology everywhere, that the antimatter black holes whistle, and they do so in the key of B-flat. B-flat. Who knew? Interlude 2. Looking versus reading. Hearing versus listening. Smelling versus sniffing. Oh yeah, you can look at something without reading it, but you can never read without looking. The same could be said of hearing and listening. The latter requires the former, whilst the former just is. Perhaps it might be fair to say, then, that in the case of reading, or listening, or sniffling, translation forms the hinge of its truth. It gives reading, listening, sniffing, a kind of unspecified mobility and depth, an immediate surface circuitry, a surface circuitry somewhat absent from simply looking, simply hearing, simply smelling. But if this is really the case, then it means that there must be at least two types of is's at one and the same time. The is that just is, and the one that is to be. I want to say that this two-headed is has something to do with duration, length, distance, intensity, speed. But that, perhaps that, is another matter, a mobile, multimediated, ars erotica, ars scientifica, immaterial, materialized matter. Camouflage. The double-headed is's, installations, curve time, speed, energy, imagination, truth game, ethics, aesthetics, a minority strategy, a slice of life. It was once intoned by Deleuze and Guattari in tongue that God's a lobster, a double pincer, a double bind, a plurality of the one that is several at the same instant, at the same duration, the same place, the same rhythm, the same breath, content, remark, a kind of viscerally disemboweled geography which nevertheless remains contiguously embodied, infinitely expanding, deeply disruptive, morally suspect, and a little bit monstrous. Or in a word, the camouflaneur, the artist as a double act, the camouflaneur of our postmodern time. The bruise. The question becomes, or indeed maybe it always has been, how does one account for the condition of life, including one's own life, its harshness or its coolness, the thickness of its blood, the tones of its savagery, the levels of its anger, the severities of its crime, a plurality of the one that is several at the same instant, at the same duration, the same place, same rhythm, same breath, same content, remark, a kind of viscerally disemboweled geography which nevertheless remains contiguously embodied, infinitely expanding, deeply disruptive, morally suspect, and as we said, a little bit monstrous. Like Bataille, the sacred and profound, like Bataille, the sacred and profane, rub up against the mediocre, but unlike Bataille, its syntheses, intensities, values can be discarded, deterritorialized, disembodied, and reconfigured. And it does so by putting forward in ethics and aesthetics a kind of weird stylistics of existence. Child's play. So picture this. Picture this game, a child's game, well known for its immediate sense of dysfunctionality writ large, the game of musical chairs. For the purpose of establishing a common memory data bank, shall I recap the game as follows? A series of chairs are set out in a line with one too many participants for the amount of given chairs. A gun goes off, the music begins, and the children run around the chairs frantically attempting to be near this or that chair so that when the music stops suddenly and on the wrong beat, they must grab and sit on chair, rule number one. The game is already skewed, we all know this from the start. One player will always already be caught without a chair. The one caught out when silence descends, well, they must exit, stay at the sidelines, go somewhere else, get lost. Loser, rule number two. The game is repeated until there are only two participants and one isolated chair left. You know, I never liked this game, whether or not I managed to be victorious with the one remaining chair. Who cares about the chairs anyway? I was always more curious about the play of the game. Of course, this curiosity meant that I always played to the bitter end, this silly little game. A few questions and answers. Question. When is a curve no longer a line or a point? Answer. When it morphs into an imaginary number where n is part real, part make-believe. Question. When is an imaginary number no longer a vector curve? Answer. When its rhizomatic spreadsheet is conditioned by its molecular regime. Question. When is the condition of a molecular regime problematic? Answer. When that molecular regime is able, just because it can, to install the war machine, as the Marines would call it, into every available hole and niche and quadrant. Question. Well, when is a war machine able to install itself everywhere at any time without too much or any awareness or resistance that a hyperfascism that is starting to implant and grow? That is to say, when can the war machine install itself just because it can? Answer. When the morphed continuum recursivity's viral load paradoxically subsumes the dividing lines while simultaneously resurrecting segmented strata. Translation. Oh, it has nothing to do with false consciousness, and even less to do, at least at the beginning, with identity politics, nationalism, and ethnicities. It is rather a particular kind of bureaucracy, a particular kind of managerialism, a particular kind of art school, art mutation, switching over Europe, old and new, at this very moment as we speak. It is a paradoxically situated situation, both binarily coded and deeply open-ended. Quote, the masses certainly do not passively submit to power, observe the delusive Atarian eye, nor do they want to be repressed in a kind of mechanistic hysteria, nor are they tricked by ideological lure. Desire is never separable from complex assemblages that necessarily tie into molecular levels, from microformations already shaping postures, attitudes, perceptions, expectations, energy, but itself results from a highly developed, engineered set rich in interactions, a whole supple segmentarity that processes molecular energy and potentially gives desire a fascistic determination. Leftist organizations will not, sadly, be the last to secrete those microfascisms any more than the right. On the uses then and misuses then of kneeling. Perhaps after all this, it is safer to say then that all those zeros and ones, lines and points, segments and infinites, fudge factors and darings, thieveries and scientists, perhaps all these fractals have more to do with the necessity to submit. And not only that, to know when and how, without knowing why exactly, without knowing to whom, without knowing to what one kneels. On the other hand, perhaps this kind of fractality has nothing to do with kneeling or any other form of submission. And I've just been carried away with trying to explain what happens when I slip out the uncharted path in a manner according to my custom, especially when night sells for day, or the stillness of the air, the light, the dew, the quietness of tone. You know, the possibility to connect a this with a that? Perhaps what I'm mentioning has only a tiny microslice to do with submission, but I mention it anyway for no other reason than that the combination of light and touch and sound and smell compels me to inhabit my body differently, now aligned, now maligned, with a stranger series of curiosities, hungers, expectations, promises, threats. Oh, this has very little to do with losing, or conversely, with finding myself or any self. It's peculiar submission, perhaps even a peculiar mastery, this gutter ground gift, this instant eventness of desire and pleasure and discipline and wandering, this holy place of the bended knee. But perhaps I'm confusing the formal requirements of philosophy, capital P, and art, capital A, science, capital S, and religion, capital R, with their bastardized cousins, greed, hunger, curiosity, sloth, the need to know law. I tell you something you do not need to know. According to government protocol, you have the duty to report me as a spy, or at worst, a leak. According to military protocol, you have the duty to report me as a messenger who may or may not be shot. According to educational protocol, you have the duty to report me as research, and in so doing, footnote that exchange. But I'd like to make a plea. I'd like to say that the need to know law is all in the wrist, closer to new forms of social agency and economy, the kind of how you play the game, how the game plays you, whilst the band just plays on. Ownership in the 21st century is intellectual property and the need to know. Oh, you know, it's a delicate game we're playing, after all.